Sorry, you gotta go back. This time, just don't fuck your sister.
Rubbing lotion into mama's hair. Then I gently help her wax her back. Give her some soup, then give her a bath. This is how I show her how love lasts.
Or your mom. Or your mom.
That a human being has. A human being can actually reach a state of perfect and complete awakening. In-
you didn't listen to any of that.
Sometimes it's hard.
Make time I can't replace. Sister, oh sister, you're always on my mind. I wish I could go back something like a strong.
Please just stop.
To see that the power to liberate others arises from seeing the true nature of reality more deeply. One has to aspire to remove all one's subtle veils of ignorance and to realize the supreme awakening.
I saw her there, smooching with a hot dog. Oh, the love.
No, sister.
Properly in an absolute sense. Thus, the Bodhisattva has two great aspirations.
Look, just try to be nice this time.
Try to be nice.
And don't fuck your sister.
Watching you walk down that aisle so blessed. And my mind drifts back to days long gone. When we were just kids singing our own song.
Halfway through, you didn't fuck.
Ra means mind only or merely mind. As at the Sravaka stage, at the Sittamatra stage.
And I remember the way you'd steal my hot dog. With a mischievous grin and a laugh, oh Lord. Those memories play in my mind never.
No self that could be the creator of such a fantasy world. Essentially the Sittamatran approach, like any Buddhist approach, is based on direct experience. Following the Srava.
Do you really want to just keep going back there? Is it still making you happy? Reincarnate, fuck your sister, get old and die. Just don't fuck your sister.
At the bar, free to go. Brother and sister, just like the old days of yore. I packed a picnic basket with goodies aplenty. Little did I know my sister had a secret. I saw her there smooching with a hot dog. Oh, the love was in the air. It made me a god. She had.
Okay, you wanna fuck around and find out? I'm gonna make you a podcaster this time.
And I heard Father singing, calling out to me. He was calling through my darkness from his sunlit throne, singing songs of freedom that call his children home. Helping me remember I never was alone, for Father had been there with me. Wherever I had roamed, he had been with me at the glory hole, where glory can't be found. He had been with me when I walked the streets on the darkest side of town. If I had only listened, I might have heard his tune. And if you listen closely, I'll think you'll hear him too. He is calling through your darkness from his sunlit throne, singing songs of freedom that call his children home. Helping you remember you've never been alone, for he is always with you wherever you may roam. So pull the cotton from your ears while you still have time. Don't worry about your dollars, your nickels or your dimes. Cause the song that money sings, it only leads astray. But Father's song of freedom is showing you the way. He is calling through your darkness from his sunlit throne, singing songs of freedom that call his children home, helping you remember you've never been alone, for he is always with you wherever you may roam.
Greetings to you, my loves. It is I, Trussell, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and this is my current incarnation as a podcaster. A huge shout out to Suno.ai, which allowed me to make all of the songs that you heard up front. I've never seen anything like it ever. You just prompt it and it will make a song for you. And as you could see, I made a lot of high-level, beautiful, romantic songs with Suno.ai, and I made them all for National Sisters Day. But yeah, check it out. It will blow your mind. It's crazy. It's less than 5 minutes. It just spits out a song, and it's worth like learning how to use it, because you can actually, at first you might think you can only make 1 minute songs, but there's ways to continue the song and you don't have to prompt it. If you have lyrics that you want it to sing, just type your lyrics in, say what genre of music you want, and it'll spit out two different versions of it. They are not a sponsor, but I feel indebted to them because they have created a technology that, if you've been listening to my podcast, you know this is a dream come true. And it also freaks me the fuck out that in minutes, this thing can just make a song. And not that bad. Some of them suck, but every once in a while, it'll just spit out something that's beautiful. And then if you do know how to do any kind of sound design, production, anything, my God, you can just drop that baby into Ableton and shine it up. It is so fun. So definitely check them out. Suno.ai. Or if you're in a fight with your girlfriend or wife, my God, you can make her a love song in less than 5 minutes. It works. Today, we have a wonderful podcast for you. I'm sure you're familiar with David Nickturn. He's David from the Midnight Gospel. He's been on the DTFH many a time. Also, I'm lucky enough to call him my meditation teacher. Maybe not so lucky for him. But did you know he has a brilliant, scholarly son who has written many fantastic books on Buddhism, including The Dharma of the Princess Bride? And he has a great podcast called The Road Home, which I hope that you will subscribe to. This podcast couldn't have come at a better time because Ethan's dad recommended this intense book that I finally finished called Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness. It's definitely one of the best, if not the best, books on meditation I've ever read. Very simple, yet the simplicity of a razor. It's incredible. It deconstructs your identity. I had a couple of moments of existential vertigo. And if you do decide to read it, I hope that you will stick it out, because it really does is pull the rug out from under your feet and the walls and the stuff behind the walls and the things seeing the walls. And there's a real intense moment that happens right around the middle of the book, at least for me, but it resolves in the most beautiful, sweet, incredible way. And part of what was awesome about reading this book is I got to do this podcast with Ethan in the middle of it, and I got to interrogate him about some of these really intense, very complex, seemingly complex Buddhist topics that I really don't know anything about, because I have an acid fried dad brain, and it's like an old chicken tender that somebody wrapped in a few sheets of very high grade acid and then folded up in a nice bundle of marijuana leaves and then rolled in a ketamine flour and then baked in the oven of time for 49 years. So I need help. I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm past the point in my life of having to feel like I'm smart. I admit I don't know what this means. And when I listen to audiobooks like this, I'm so good. It just, I don't know what that means. I don't know what a Madhavacakkhata stage of dharmic realization on the third level of the seventh tripeka is, which is why I need people like Ethan and David in my life. You know, I don't blame anybody living in the West for having a real aversion to the concept of the spiritual teacher. you know, you get the wrong spiritual teacher, their fingers are going to be up your butt in 2 ayahuasca ceremonies. But I mean, maybe you want that. Not my thing, not in ayahuasca, but you do need someone. I mean, my friend is teaching me how to do kettlebells. That's not exciting. Basic, just picking up like a lump of, I don't even know what they're made of, neutron star material, and figuring out how to zing it around in a way that doesn't cause me to go into a full paralysis for the rest of my life. I need someone to teach me that. I need somebody to teach me how to change diapers, fold diapers. You should see me try to fold up any baby related anything. I will go into a furious rage within seconds. These bastards who make anything that a parent needs to haul a child around that has to get folded to go in the car and unfolded, they're the same people who made the fucking Hellraiser cube. And if you're listening, why? You know that the transitions are the most difficult time, not just for parents, but also for human beings, because we go into the fucking bardo, and you know we get chased by our own projections all around until we reincarnate and then have to deal with an incensed parent, sweating stress, sweats, stinking of cortisol and vodka as they try to figure out how to unravel the puzzle box that is your stroller. So come on, it's the age of AI. Ask an AI how to do it. I want a button, a simple button, even better, a voice command. And obviously I don't want my kid to be able to voice command the stroller to fold up, because they would do it instantly. The point is, if you need help with strollers and kettlebells, you're probably gonna need a little bit of help when it comes to an over 2,000 year old highly evolved philosophical system. So this is why you're about to hear me riddle poor Ethan with dumb questions regarding this amazing Buddhist text, which again, I hope you will check it out. It's called Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness. I couldn't recommend the Audible more, though I am going to order the book itself so I can read it again and do that stupid thing where you underline stuff, imagining that at some point when you become a scholar, you're going to go back and look at your underlines, which you never do. Or even worse, you're like, maybe someone will actually see that I read a book. It's like the way dogs piss on fire hydrants because you want people to know you read. Isn't that embarrassing? Get ready, my friends, for a wonderful podcast. And also, this is very accessible. It's a cool conversation just on identity itself, on manifestation. We're not just going to go like full Buddhist nerd on you, so don't worry. Don't skip it. You'll like it. I have some wonderful dates coming up. I'm really excited to get out there on the road, though I do
love spending time at home with the family.
I'm going to be at the Comedy Works downtown January 11th through the 13th. That's Denver, one of my favorite clubs. Then not long after that, I'll be at Helium. I love Heliums in Indianapolis. It's the 25th through the 27th. If you are listening to this, by the way, there are tickets left for New Year's Eve. You want to come celebrate New Year's Eve with me at the mothership? I would be honored to bring in the new year with you. You're going to sit at home smelling your farts, watching that stupid ball and what's his face get hammered with what's his face? No fun. Watch me get hammered with you at the Comedy Mothership New Year's Eve. I'm going to be there. Helium, already said that. Hyenas Comedy Club, April 12th. And there's dates in between that I have yet to populate my podcast website with. They'll be up soon, but you can find all these dates at DuncanTrussell.com. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram. I announce when I have shows coming up if you forgot any of these. Also, if you want commercial-free episodes of the DTFH and what is currently a sporadic gathering of people, I'm sorry about that, my dear patrons. We will get back on schedule after the holidays. Go to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe, please. All right, one last plug, but not for me. If you are interested in taking the probably the deepest dive you could take into Buddhism, outside of getting taken by slea stacks down into the hollow earth and studying with ancient Tibetans who've been living down there for the last 2,000 years, then you should go to dharmamoon.com and sign up for Ethan's upcoming year-long course. It's a year-long course. It's Buddhist studies. And after you listen to this episode, I think you'll realize how powerful and incredible and probably a little intense this course is going to be. It's at dharmamoon.com. If you can't remember that link, you can find it at duncantrussell.com. Okay, everybody, please welcome back to the DTFH, Ethan Nickturn. Ethan, welcome back to the DTFH. How's it going?
It's going well. I mean, I feel like the last time we talked, not over brief text, a lot of things were different in both of our lives and the world. So it's great to see you.
Great to see you too. Yeah. And you're right. My God. We talked in a different universe, basically, than the one we're in right now. We were in the before times.
I have wanted to tell you for a while that watch the Midnight Gospel, which I'm sure a lot of people who listen to your podcast have watched, but I haven't gotten to tell you and watch the whole thing. Obviously, it was fun to see my dad cursing as an animated character, but that's pretty on brand for him. So, I mean, my whole life is my dad kind of as an animated character in real life, so... But that last episode with your mom just absolutely destroyed me. That was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen about the cycle of life and death. So I just wanted to
thank you
for that.
For folks in listening, Ethan is David Nickturn's kid. So they're both
40 something year old kid.
A kid at heart. They're both. Buddhists, and you are working at Dharma Moon now. You're helping your dad out with his foundation. Yeah. What do you call it? Is it a foundation? I would never know what to call it.
It's a organization. It's online. So where are things centered? You know, I'm right in Brooklyn right now. You're in Charlotte. Like, where is this sent? Where does this live?
Yeah.
So Dharma Moon is kind of like that, but it's an online meditation and Buddhist community with lots of great, programs, meditation teacher training. I lead the year-long Buddhist studies program, which has 2 years in it. You can just do the first year, but starts up in late January. And yeah, it's a really great growing community and lots of great online downloads and, full-on live courses with other humans who are either near you or far away. So definitely recommend it.
You know, what's fascinating to me about Buddhism is that the Buddhism you think it is so different from the Buddhism you start finding out it is the more you study, the deeper you go into it. You know, then I remember the Buddhism I learned about in college, basic stuff, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Middle Way, but then when you start digging deeper and deeper and realize how complex it can get and how detailed it can get and how it sometimes I feel like I'm reading a medical journal or something in its analysis of the psyche and how, detailed and complete that analysis seems to be. And that to me, it's on the same level as like any Western psychologist, Freud, Jung, anything like that, and the fact that it is so much older is really astounding. I wonder what Freud would have thought if he had found like the right Tibetan texts, you know, breaking down the workings of the psyche or what the mind is.
Yeah. I mean, I have studied quite a lot of Western psychology. It's also a philosophical and metaphysical tradition. So because it's so much older, I would say it's actually much deeper. That's in no way to diss or drag, as the kids say, Western psychology, because there's so much good cross-pollination between Eastern thought and modern Western thought. But it would be more like if Freud had lived 2,500 years ago and, you know, all these other modalities that have come about, like internal family systems has a huge amount of crossover with Buddhism, neuroscience, evolutionary biology. And there were 2,500 years of people kind of steeping in those practices and teachings, evolving them, taking them into different cultural locales, you know, which in the early world was mostly in Asia. So the idea of the globalization of meditative practice and those contemplative disciplines brings in a lot of different, you know, cultures. And so, yeah, it's much deeper and broader. And then it's also a philosophical and metaphysical tradition. So it's also meeting, you know, conversations with like what Nietzsche or Sartre did, you know, so it's, I don't think it's any better than those. I just think it's older. And because it's so much about personal reflective contemplative experience, it's evolved through so many generations. It's, you know, I was watching Netflix. There's this, I like to watch the cooking shows on Netflix, the like chef's table shows. And there's one about a restaurant in Mexico City called Pujol, where I can't remember the name of the head chef, but he seemed like a really cool character. There's a mole sauce that's over 3 years old when it gets served to you, which sounds like it could be gross, but it's
dangerous.
You know, it's a three Michelin star. Could be dangerous, but it's a three Michelin star restaurant. And that idea of the sauce keeping steeping, keeping adding spices, keeping adding experience. So yeah, if Western psychology gets to 2,500 years old, I would say then it's where Buddhism is now.
Great point. Yeah. Okay. That's really cool. I wonder if you could help me understand something that, and maybe you're not familiar with it. I've got all these books on my Kindle and just randomly pulled one up that I don't remember downloading called As It Is. It's a, different students of this Tibetan guru sort of describing him. It's a devotional text basically. But in it, they talk about a practice that their guru did called something like pointing out the mind. Have you ever heard of this before? The mind pointing out?
Yes.
What is that?
Yeah, that is, I mean, I believe that book was, I think it was Tulku Ogyen Rinpoche, who was the father of several younger Tibetan lamas who are prominent now. Probably the most famous of them is Mingyur Rinpoche, who teaches a lot in the West. And
I love his books. They're incredible.
Yeah, he wrote a book called In Love with the World about leaving his monastery in the middle of the night and freaking out all of his, you know, because he's a beloved lama and just going and living as a homeless person for 3 years in India and almost dying. And so his father, Tulku Ogyen, is considered one of the greatest tantric teachers of the 20th century and was a holder of a lineage called Dzogchen, or the Great Perfection, which is a series of very simple meditative techniques working with resting in mind as it is, right? The idea of awareness as it is, always already having wakefulness to it that is then obscured or covered over by layers of our inherited habitual reactivity and confusion, et cetera. And so pointing out the nature of mind, or sometimes called introduction to the nature of mind, it's basically the central premise of all tantric Buddhist practice. So when I say tantric Buddhist, that's the form of Buddhism that really flourished in the Himalayan region, especially sometimes it's called Tibetan Buddhism, although at this point we're so post-Tibetan. So I think tantric Buddhism is a better name for it. And the idea is that you're doing all these practices. Some of them are very ornate visualization or mantra practices, but at their essence, they're also very simple. They're working directly with resting in awareness as a space that is containing all of our experience, and our mind at essence being this wakeful, warm, luminous, but ungraspable container for whatever emotion, whatever experience of ourselves or the world arises. And so the introduction to the nature of mind, or pointing out the nature of mind, is a set of transmissional instructions that are hard to describe because they're done in different ways. And it's very simple, where the whoever is the lineage holder, often called the Lama in the Tibetan tradition, will introduce or reintroduce, because you can receive this instruction multiple times, that notion of pure awareness and the ability to just rest momentarily in pure awareness to the student. And that's the basis of the student's path forward in working with whatever actual formal meditation practice they're working with, or just being in the world in relational spaces. Or, you know, it'd be nice if we were introduced to awareness while on our smartphone, right? But that's a harder space.
Is that impossible? Is that possible?
There's a lot of force. I think it's possible, because anywhere experience goes, mind goes, which also means awareness goes. From the standpoint of a supportive environment for doing that, I would say it's designed to be an unsupportive environment, you know.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's like one of those video games where you get more and more challenging as you go up the ladder. It would be a more advanced practice. I mean, there's literally hundreds of psychologists working on the bigger apps trying to figure out how to steal our awareness rather than empower us with it. So there's a lot of smart people trying to figure out how to make it harder.
The other book I'm reading, which your dad introduced me to, it's called Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness, I think is what it's called. And oh, it's good.
Right.
Really good. Really, like, it's my favorite thing, in that it's kind of painful, because it's sort of pulling every time you feel like you've sort of assimilated what it's saying and you found some ground there, it's pulling that ground out from under you, and you get to really encounter that part of the mind that doesn't want to recognize its emptiness. You know, the part of the mind, at least at first, that seems to be at odds with anything that is sort of pointing out the inherent dependent or empty or imaginary quality of everything. And it's the best. I'm glad you brought up Sartre, because I would get the same kind of feeling reading like hardcore existentialism, just this sense of like, someone touching, like, I don't know, this is a weird way to describe it. You ever have anyone put their finger in your belly button?
I have, yeah.
I hate it.
I mean, not a philosopher, more like a girl. My daughter likes to get the lint. No, never. It's either a girlfriend, a wife, or a daughter. And my daughter actually likes to get the lint out of my belly button.
I wish a philosopher would poke my belly button, like it's some weird blessing. But that is, it's
I just want to tell your listeners, my daughter's in first grade, so it's still appropriate. If she was like a teenager trying to get the lint out of my belly button, I'd set a boundary. But she's,
you know, that's when we run into a weird territory.
No, it's no good. Boundaries.
That's a squirmy feeling. And it's that same kind of feeling, because the rational part of your mind is recognizing how astute and clearly well thought out the entire systematic description of how consciousness emerges through the skandhas, as they call them, it's so good. And also that, like, he presents, you will be thinking a counter argument to what he's saying And then he will say, you might be thinking this, and it's your shitty counter argument, which he then dispels, leaving you with a rug pulled out from under you. But I'm really interested in the, I can't remember the entire name, Aaliyah. It's sort of like with the skandhas, you have this sort of layering that leads to what we would call our identity or reality or the experience of reality. And at the base of that, there's this description of this kind of oceanic, primary, fundamental, primordial place that all of this stuff is emerging from. And that place, you sometimes in meditation, sometimes just in walking around, I feel like I can tune into that place. And it's wonderful in that, you know, it's a remembering of, I think, something from my childhood of like, oh, you really don't have to have any reason to be happy. Like this is, it's not going to get better than this place. And, but the part that I'm confused about and the part that really like, just as I was like, oh, okay, well, this is a good place. Now there's a place to rest in here. He then points out that because this place of awareness is dependent on something to be aware of, it also is not some perma structure. It also is not anything you can, you know, put your tent poles into. Am I misunderstanding this?
No, you're description? Not. No, right. I mean, just to give a little more context, that book, which is was written and was a series of oral teachings by another Tibetan scholar named Kenpo Soltram Gyamso, compiled by his students. So there's Buddhist practice, and then there's Buddhist philosophy, which has also evolved over 2,500 years. And the Tibetans more recently put all of the different, within Buddhism, there's multiple philosophical systems that evolved in different cultures and different teachers that kind of make different frameworks. And all of the frameworks are really around exploring relative truth and ultimate truth, right? So just simply put, relative truth is the fact that there's a guy named Ethan, you know, in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. There's a guy named Duncan in Charlotte, North Carolina, told me he had to perform last night in a place with not a good ghost, like a bad ghost. That's what happened before we got on, right? So that's the ghost is relative. I completely believe you, by the way. So that's all of that is relative truth, right? We're in a position relative to other things. We have an existence. We have thoughts. We have personalities. This is all real on the relative level.
Yeah.
And then there's ultimate truth, right? And basically, when you look, so there's different systems of philosophy that evolved over time. And in that book, basically what he's doing is arranging the systems of philosophy in stages so that the sort of different philosophical arguments about what is relatively true and what is ultimately true sort of go up a ladder of increasing subtlety. And it's completely around this idea of increasingly subtle ideas about ourself or ideas about reality that we might be holding on to, right?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, when you look at the thing about, you know, I mean, evolutionary biology and neuroscience has done a really better job than Buddhism explaining why this is true recently. Basically, you know, the human mind and the human brain, to survive, we try to create patterns, right? We try to recognize things in patterns, which that's not actually what's happening. You know, like nothing that's happening in our visual field is actually kind of definable through a pattern. Nothing that's happening in our mental or emotional field can be solidified into like just these categories, right? But we try to like solidify it into so that we can label and know, you know, and we know that's what that kind of experiences. This is what this kind of experience is, right? Basically to survive, right? Like we want to know what food is poisonous, what food is sweet, what food has nourishment in it.
We're doing like
so that we don't have to.
It's a neurological augmented reality. So there's reality and then you are overlaying on top of that reality some series of judgments. This is brown. That's red. This is a stoplight. That's a green light. That means I can go. Friend, enemy. And so this is all happening instantaneously on top of, and this is that, and that's that. And those are two separate things, even though on one level they might be separate, but they're certainly part. Like if you're in a building, there's the door, there's the wall. And you might say to yourself, well, the door is different from the wall. But if you're looking at the building, it's just one building. It's one thing. But you're breaking it up in this spontaneous, instantaneous way. And this is how reality forms around you, right? That's the idea.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, sometimes we form those categories and make those patterns in ways that are mostly accurate. You know, like, no, for example, knowing psychologically if I'm a person who experiences a lot of anger or experiences a lot of addictive desire, that could help me, right, navigate the world being kinder to myself and more skillful towards others. But what happens when we define patterns and categories is there always is an inaccuracy because, you know, it's like trying to hold the water in a river still. It's not.
Right.
The water is not actually there, you know, the next day. It's somewhere far away. And so the idea is if we just rest in our conceptual patterns or just rely on our conceptual patterns, they ossify, they harden. And the more we do that, the more we mistake reality, the less present we are, the less compassionate we are, and the more we suffer, and the more we probably cause suffering for others as well. So the relative truth gets at the idea of how do we hone our pattern recognition so that we actually are making mostly accurate assessments about our relative and relational reality. But ultimately speaking, no pattern is fixed, right? And that gets at this notion first of non-self, then it gets at this notion of emptiness, right? And yet there is this, you know, the alia, which you're talking about, which literally means something like ground, right? Is this sort of, it's related to the conversation we were having about the pointing out the nature of mind. It's this basic space of knowing, of experiencing that is holding the whole thing, you know, that's not a pattern. It's actually just a knowing, luminous space of what you could say unfabricated mind. Right. So going through the philosophical arguments about here's the arguments people made about what is real and verifiable and what is not, you get slowly to this truth of emptiness, which is, you know, he's in dialogue and discourse with other philosophical traditions throughout that book, because that's how Buddhism evolved. It evolved in relationship to all kinds of different philosophical systems, philosophies that were pretty nihilistic about the universe, like there is nothing and nothing matters, and philosophies that, to use the Buddhist framing, would be considered transcendent or eternalistic, like there is a permanent soul or permanent God, and all you have to do is reach for them and fix yourself to them, and then all will be good, you know?
Yeah.
And figuring out the subtleties of all these philosophies where they basically fixated on some relative truth and mistook the relative truth to be ultimately true, right? And so that ultimate truth in Buddhism has this placeholder name of emptiness, right?
Yeah.
It's like that's what we call the idea that reality is not solid, right?
Got it.
None of this is solid. It's happening very much. The flip side of that is luminosity, which means it's brilliant. It's a flow. It's energy. It's movement. It's perception. It's emotion. But it's not happening in some fixed way that we can hold on to. But it is brilliant at the same time. Now, the problem is emptiness and luminosity are just words, right? They're more pattern recognition. Right. So the idea is ultimately you have to let go of the words too and work with awareness as a direct embodied, you could say, experience. Embodied is just
that's the trap.
That's become very popular.
It's a trap. You know, you start catching glimpses of this thing, and then of course, the first thing you want to do is like, oh, that's the thing. And then the moment you're doing, oh, that's the thing, you've in some way differentiated yourself from it by the assessment, the analysis, and for me, the infinite like river of thoughts regarding what that is. The first thing you want to do is like, oh, that's the thing. And then the moment you're doing, oh, that's the thing, you've in some way differentiated yourself from it by the assessment, the analysis, and for me, the infinite like river of thoughts regarding what that is. And one of those thoughts I've had is I do see how, you know, in the Hindu tradition, if there were people meditating, if there were people like exploring consciousness and they came upon the aliyah, the ground floor, I do see how you would say, that's my soul. Well, that must be the soul there. That is some
or that's permanent... God.
Yes, both. I mean, that this is the both of these things have popped into my head, which is, oh, it's some divine quality. It has a kind of divinity to it, or an eternalist transcendent quality to it that is very exciting. And then the other thought is, oh, this must be what they're talking about when they talk about the soul, the Atman. This must be it. And so that was sort of the disconcerting moment as I'm listening to this. And then of course, like, that's what it leads into. Like you're saying, it's progressive. Right away, it talks about, no, don't get confused. Not the soul, not God. Actually, as dependent as anything else, and that for awareness to exist, it must have something to be aware of, and thus it can't have any kind of real permanence unless you want to bank on there forever being things to be aware of, which was, you know, not, I didn't feel like that was good news. It bothered me. Like, it really like threw a sand in my diaper, in my very empty diaper.
What? Why did it bother you?
Well, because like I want, some part of me wants there to be a soul. Some part of me wants there to be an individuated packet of meanness, or some, you know what I mean? That is me. This is my soul. And you have your soul, and I have my soul, and this thing is lasting. This thing does persist. And also just basic hedonism, like encountering the thing, I don't want it to go away. Like I want that to be forever, because it's so incredibly, it's such a relief to stumble upon that thing. I mean, it's a relief. It's like, oh, wow, I don't have to be happy for any reason. I don't need some excuse to be happy. Or maybe happiness is the wrong balance, or feel peace. I don't need the world to align with my desires. This thing doesn't seem to give a shit about any of that at all. And that feels like really good. So yeah, a lot of attachment, you know, a lot of not wanting that to go away, even though it's like thing that has always been there underneath everything, it appears.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's where the relative truth becomes really useful, which is in terms of you want your individuation. I mean, you already have it. You know, that's the good thing,
right?
Like, there's never going to be another person living Duncan Trussell or Ethan Nickturn's subject positions in this time and place, you know, with this kind of unique conglomeration of experiences. So it's the relative truth is already happening to a certain degree. And also, you know, without the relative truth, without there being an experience or set of experiences arising, there actually couldn't be this experience of emptiness, luminosity. It would just be voidness. It would be nihilism. It would be the black hole, you know, but it's because there are these specific expressions of sentiency and, you know, luminous moments happening in a stream that have very specific experiences that it's empty. So that's, you know, that's the flip side of the coin, is that relative and ultimate truth can't actually exist without each other. So, but that idea of arrival is an interesting one, right? Like, cause that exists throughout spirituality, you know, throughout our, you know, it exists if, you know, you get into a more fundamentalist approach to Christianity or, you know, or another tradition. And like, once you accept Jesus, that's it, you're done. Doesn't matter what happens after that. That's some people's approach to Christianity. You know, it happens if, you know, you have, you know, a peak spiritual experience with plant medicine or ayahuasca, right? I had this amazing insight, you know, it's like, great. How are you living your life? You know, you're back from Peru now, how's life going, you know?
Yeah.
And, it happens if you go on a Buddhist meditation retreat and you're like, my mind slowed down. I was open. I made friends, and I've done this. You hear the sound and you really understand the dialogue of birds talking to each other in the trees, like full on, like they were having their podcast. And you're like, I know emotionally exactly what these birds are saying to each other. And it didn't feel like a trip. But then it's the next moment, right? The conversation ends and there's something else to show up to. So that grasping, it makes so much sense, because it's the longing to live from a more genuine, open-hearted experience.
Yes.
But then you have to do it again.
Right. Yeah,
you have to do it again. There's another moment. Yeah.
There's another moment, and it is a different moment altogether. And yeah, and so that's the collision to me. I mean, that is the collision where the suffering emerges from. That's the fault line, is that that is the truth, what you just said. And you just don't want that to be, honestly, like, there's a comedian, Mark Maron. He's got a great joke about Scientology, how he's afraid to read Dianetics, because he thinks he's like, you know, because like at some point I'm just worried. I'm like, you know, this makes a lot of sense. But Scientology, I did hear one thing, a Scientologist term, which is you're in disagreement with the universe. You have a disagreement with the universe. And you know what I mean? This is probably not a good position to be in, is to like be at odds with as things are. And yet that seems to be the general human predicament, is one of this kind of, I don't want it to be moments. I want there to be some connective tissue between these things that carry over to some degree that allows me to transport the epiphanous moment from one to the next, thus no longer having to reset, repeat the exploratory process. It's laziness, I guess.
Well, there is a connective, space that is sentient. You know, that's what we're talking about. It's in Buddhist terminology of the tantric, or what's called the Mahayana tradition, it's either called Rigpa, you know, primordial awareness. It can be called the Alaya in Sanskrit, the ground of awareness, a ground of consciousness. It can be called ultimate bodhicitta, awakened heart or awakened mind. So, but it's not a thing, right? It's not objectifiable. It's a space that is containing, you know. Right. I mean, that's how I felt about you know, the last episode of your show, where you and your mother are, you know, becoming, right? There is a continuity there. That's actually what Tantra literally means, is thread of continuity, that there's this constant, one becomes the other's child and then grows old and then rebirths.
Yeah.
And like that there must be a connective tissue, you know, to achieve that level of realization. You must already know that there is that connective tissue. It's just the tissue is not, it's I made with my daughter, because we watched this series called Emily's Wonder Lab, I think. So there's this substance oobleck that you can make out of is it cornstarch or but it's basically when you just let it sit in your hand, it solidifies, but the second you try to grasp it, it liquefies. That's what awareness feels like.
That's cool.
Oobleck.
Yeah, that's cool. It's a non-Newtonian superfluid. Yeah, that's a good description. Yes,
exactly.
Okay, so I want to bring up something. It's an angle on Buddhism that I don't hear brought up a lot, because sort of like in Buddhism, there's a lot of acknowledgement of certain possibilities, but the acknowledgement isn't an invitation to explore these possibilities, but generally a warning regarding these possibilities. So in Tantric Buddhism, you do hear about sorcery a lot. Stories of sorcerers and the sort of shitty karma that comes from it. But before I get to the main point, I've been reading, have you ever heard of Neville Goddard?
Heard the name, but not familiar.
So he's, I guess you could call him like a Christian mystic. And so he takes his perspective on the Bible is that it's disguised as a history, but it's really a psychological analysis of human existence that contains within it all of these keys that were meant for like the initiated, like the priest, since that used to be the priest class. The priest class would sort of reveal the true meaning behind these stories to you. But then he said, you know, the priests have forgotten that. So now everyone's a literalist when it comes to the Bible. And so they're just licking the side of the jar that has the honey inside of it. And so an example of this would be, you know, the Virgin Mary, the story of the virgin birth. He says, this isn't about some teenager who gets humped by God and then has God's kid. The Virgin Mary is a symbol for what I think he would agree was the Aliyah, the ground consciousness, which is this untainted, untouched womb, a space within which the divine consummation is the identity, the body, the human incarnation has come into this perfect virginal space. And then the birth of Jesus is the birth of your own realization. That's the divine birth. And, but that's an example of like how deep and weird he gets with his analysis of all of these things. But
that sounds great. Again,
it's cool, man. It's like the next, cause you know, having studied Buddhism for so long and then hearing this stuff and being able to connect these completely different traditions in ways where, oh my God, well, if that's the case, I know both of these maps. But his premise is that this ground consciousness, and again, this is where there would be a disagreement, is God. So this is the I am in the Bible, I am that I am. This is God. And that because it's the ground floor of things, it's from this ground that everything that is in the world of humanity emerges, or anything in general. And there seems to be a parallel in this progressive stages of meditation as it talks about how this anything you're seeing in the world is just this ground oceanic consciousness undulating in certain waveforms that you have identified as reality, but it's all coming from this ocean of experience. Now, here's where it gets into something that I guess, at least I haven't heard a lot of in Buddhism. Maybe you could correct me. His premise is because of that, because you are fundamentally the ground floor, that's, you are the ocean of reality. That is the thing from which all things manifest. You can, by tuning into that ground consciousness, begin to make things happen in your own life, begin to manifest that. Prayer itself is a connection, is not saying, like, you know, words to someone and hoping he gets the letter, but that it's reconnecting with that. And in that reconnection, a natural emergence of not just awareness, enlightenment, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, but literally you can start producing any kind of reality that you want in your own life. Which, and then I thought, oh fuck it. So is that sorcery? Is that a magical system? Would Buddhists look at that and say, that's magic? Like that, yes, maybe possible, but don't get caught up in this possibility that seems to be attached to waking up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can probably find Buddhist texts where they say, you know, don't engage in this, these arts or that arts. There's the Tibetan story of Milarepa, who, you know, to get back, basically had a Cinderella story, and to get back at his aunt and uncle who stole his mother's fortune when his father died, he engaged in dark magic and ended up killing like 30 people, and started studying Buddhism because he was sure he was going to hell for, you know, having accidentally killed 30 people through magic. I don't think there's anything wrong with sorcery. I mean, I think the Buddhist view is, I mean, if you can do it, I mean, I think technology to a certain degree is sorcery, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, AI seems like sorcery that's not quite manifest yet. Every time I'm on ChatGPT, I'm like, this is kind of silly, but
yeah,
this thing does not really know what it's doing yet. But I think, you know, in terms of manifesting possibilities on the relative level that haven't existed yet, I mean, I think that's just figuring out the way relative reality works, you know? So I think that the key thing from a Buddhist standpoint is the view with which we are, you know, pursuing, you know, outcomes on the relative level.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, when you look at the modern kind of wellness influencer or spiritual influencer take on manifesting, you know, I do think, I mean, in Buddhism, you know, prayer is called making aspirations, you know, so you make aspirations for your own awakening, for, you know, the benefit of your relative conventional circumstance, for the benefit of others. So I think it's a view. And, you know, in a sense, you could say that the truth of interdependence, which is the way relative truth works, is we have influence over our relative circumstance. They're very complex. You know, the influence depends on our personal karma, depends on our, you know, the relationships that we're trying to, you know, influence, depends on our social situation, whether or not there's supportive or oppressive forces. So tapping into awareness and saying, through my aspiration, through really declaring an intention, can I shift the manifestation? Can I influence? Yes, that's true. I think there's a little bit of, you know, or a lot of bit sometimes of commodification of saying, like, if you just, you need to learn my trademark system to make something happen. And then there can also be a cruelty to that because, you know, there's either unspoken or an outright spoken idea that if you don't have the life you want, it's because you haven't tapped in to your powers of manifestation. Like, it's your fault, you know, that certain things happen to you. And I think that's really problematic. You know, there's either unspoken or an outright spoken idea that if you don't have the life you want, it's because you haven't tapped in to your powers of manifestation. Like it's your fault, you know, that certain things happen to you. And I think that's really problematic. So,
okay, but wait, let me stop you there. Let me pose a counter argument to that, which, you know, I've thought the same thing. I mean, summing up the worst case, and I would hear Ramdas talk about this, and I would really like rail against it. And I still disagree with it, but it's an example in a like earlier, I don't think he would have said this in his later life, so it's early Ramdas, something along the lines of, you know, a child, a victim of sexual abuse, chose that incarnation and to grow, to learn or something like that. And that really, I found that to be a very lame woo-woo-y way of dealing with the problem of suffering. You know, it's like, well, the way to fix the guilt that I, or the shame that I'm okay and this person's not, survivor guilt or whatever, like, you know, or just general existence in the world. If you like stop ignoring the reality of what's in your computer, what's in your e-car, what, you know, that if there's any kind of lithium in there, that shit's getting mined by children, and that in the interdependency, in the web of connection, we're not just connected to a lot of suffering people, but dependent on their labor to have the modern Western experience. And so I found that to be like a way out. So these are extreme cases, but to argue for the point, certainly whatever happens to be around you right now is there because of decisions that you have made. Mostly, you know, that mostly, maybe there's aspects you didn't decide to be born. If you're a materialist, I certainly didn't decide to have diabetes. Well, I did decide that actually. That was because of decisions. I didn't decide to go bald. I didn't decide for my hair to start thinning. I didn't decide for my hair to go gray. But most things, the hotel I'm in, the clothes I'm wearing, and most importantly, my interpretation of what's around me is a decision that I'm making, maybe not on the conscious level, but instantaneously based on a habit of thought. So I think that's what he's getting at is you are, whether you want to deal with it or not, summoning up the flavor of reality that's around you. And if you've lost track of this fundamental ground floor luminous space, then probably that reality you're summoning up around you is anxiety provoking at the very least. Because for your happiness to manifest, it depends on a set of causes, a set of conditions to be aligned in some perfect way before you can be happy. Why wouldn't I would be, you're in a ocean of phenomena. You need the slot machine to hit a certain number of like whatever gold nuggets before you can feel good. So you're going to be anxious. Whereas what Goddard is saying is no, it doesn't matter what the numbers are hitting on your slot machine. Don't even worry about that. First, and he quotes this all the time, I think it's Matthew, seek ye first the kingdom of God and all things will follow. But for him, that kingdom of God, I think, is the Aaliyah fundamental ground consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I'm going to disagree with somebody these days, I always like to empathize first, because I think disagreements are never complete. And I think when we speak empathetically to say, okay, here's what I can take from that, you know, and I am going to have to disagree somewhat with Ram Dass, which is never fun, right?
No! What
a wonderful, wonderful human. But spirit, whatever that former gentleman is right now, different views on where that energy would have gone, but it's certainly still pervading. So one argument that I think you could look at in support of what you're saying is that people of similar backgrounds or similar causal situations can manifest, can seem to manifest in terms of the way they're working with their experience moment by moment very differently, right? We all have that experience of two people come from the same family, you know, or two people come from the same background or, you know, racial background or class background or culture. And, you know, one seems to be really, really like reality is out to get me. And the other one is I am the one in control of my karma or in control of, as we're using the term here, manifestation. So I think that's very true. And I do think how and in there is a level of reality that is incredibly important that individuals saying I can work with my experience directly is incredibly powerful. And we're never going to get away from that as a spiritual truth. That being said, I think there is an issue with the word, with the verb choose or decide.
Yeah.
Because the way relative truth works from a Buddhist standpoint is interdependence, which means there's always a complex set of causes and conditions, you know, that bring things into being. And it is never moment. The word choose determines the idea that it is it's moment zero, right? That there's nothing comes before as a history, and it's never moment zero, right? We're always working in this flow of dynamics.
Yeah.
And that's so cool. And the system of dynamics, you know, I mean, you know, whatever we think about the Middle East right now, and I've been listening to a lot of people on that because I feel very uneducated. October 7th was not moment zero in that situation, right? I mean, everybody would have to acknowledge that there is a much longer, much more complicated history before that happened that is influencing how the parties show up and what the different systemic forces that craft the current awful experience are. So, you know, for a person to choose their birth, I mean, there is this notion in Tibetan Buddhism that you are in the cycle of reincarnation. You're kind of knocked about by the pure projections of your karma, and then you are driven towards something that seems the most familiar of what's available. And that is what leads you to the womb, you know, of your future mother. So there's something familiar karmically or habitually about the situation in which you take birth. I think that's the Tibetan or the Tantric Buddhist view of the bardos. By the way, Pema Chodron's latest book on the rebirth and sort of the depth of how to work with dying and rebirth from a Tibetan Buddhist standpoint is just really fabulous book.
How we live is how we die.
Yeah. So I definitely recommend that. So there is a patterning that lives in our individual consciousness that if we don't develop awareness of it, we do follow it kind of blindly. And you could say that's a choice, right? But it's really the patterning of a mind that's making the choice, unless we are touching into that awareness, which gives us much more flexibility, right? Because it starts to see that there's space around the patterning that we could maybe move in a different direction. So we can have influence for sure. And I think that's how you get two people. I mean, you know, I always see this like you're going, because I'm in airports a lot. You're in airports a lot. You know, when there's a freaking shit show at the TSA, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the TSA agents is, I hate myself and I hate all of you. And hating myself and hating all of you is how I'm going to get through my shift right now.
Yes.
And then there's another TSA agent who's like, all right, folks, we're all in this together. Let's be kind to each other. I'm going to bring the positive energy. How did that person make a different choice? You know, individual choice definitely exists. I don't doubt that at all, but it does. Choices that are made out of ignorance or that are made out of both intergenerational and previous lifetime, if we believe in that, and social patterning I do think it's a little blind to call that a choice. And also, if you do manifest something because you did somebody's workshop, it's also because causes and conditions arose for that to happen, you know, which we don't always know. You know, like why did you become a successful comedian? Do you think it's entirely based on choices you made, or is a little bit of it right place, right time? Why did you become a successful comedian? Do you think it's entirely based on choices you made, or is a little bit of it right place, right time?
It's very much right place, right time. A little? Are you kidding? Like, all it's right. Pure luck. And but I will, you know, I've said.
Oh, you're disagreeing completely with Ram Dass then.
Well,
he would say you chose to be a successful comedian.
Oh, I do. No, I find that in the sort of philosophical, philosophically, when you're presented with the problem of suffering or evil in the world, especially if you want to take a theistic approach, you have to figure out a way to deal with some divine, perfect consciousness that is creative in nature and intentional. And I think the example I heard that's horrible is like a squirrel just barely survived a forest fire. It's dying. It's laying in some scorched grass, slowly expiring in agonizing pain. And so using that as an example, how does your God react to that? Squirrel, because it's the argument of you can't have a moral God, an omniscient God, and an omnipotent God. You have to pick two. You can't have an all-powerful God that's moral and lets the squirrel suffer. You have to like pick two. You can't have all three. And so if you've defined your God as all three of these things, then you have to deal with the fact that your fucking God wanted to scorch a squirrel with a forest fire for some reason that you will never understand. Or another way out, you would say, well, the squirrel chose that. The squirrel was in some reincarnation spa in the afterlife looking at the menu of possible births. It was like, you know, I think I could learn a lot from getting scorched in a forest fire. Now the blame goes from God to the squirrel. It's like, shit, man, now you shouldn't have picked that. I don't know why you picked that on the menu. Nobody picks scorched squirrel these days, but you did. So, why? Look at all the other things. Look, you could have had 1,000 dicks getting sucked at the same time by your 1,000 heads. They perfectly align above your dicks. But no, you did scorch squirrel. Why? So this again, this is all, it's just all thought experiments to sort of deal with, I think, which is more, we align here to deal with like, hey, you're trying to find someone to blame here. And that's a right. Really interesting thing to do when it comes to any big societal issue in the world, which is where does the blame, how far back do we go? If we're looking for someone responsible that we can blame for this situation, you know, how, especially with what we know about epigenetics and stuff, how far back do we go to find the villain, to find the perpetrator? Because you inevitably, like the example with Israel, you could say the same thing with Ukraine, right? Any of the big geopolitical issues right now, they didn't just start on September 11th. They didn't start on the day that the event happened. There was so many things leading up to that, to the point where if you keep going back, you can always find some factor that influenced the horrific event, even if that factor was hundreds of years in the past. And so in that, this blame gets diffused in this fascinating way. And also maybe autonomy a little bit too, I think is more what you're saying, or the general sense of free will or autonomy starts getting a little foggy when you do that.
Right. And we need room because of the example of the TSA agents, right? We need room for autonomy and free will to be there, right? So but, you know, I think that whole paradigm of blame, you know, we're always trying to do something basically good. And, you know, most of the time what we're doing is blaming ourselves, right? I'm such a fucked up. I'm not living the life that I wanted. And I think when you step into this paradigm of really looking at the mind moment by moment and looking at this ground of awareness moment by moment, accountability is important. Right. Like, oh, wow. I deviated from my awareness. Yeah. Right. I abandoned awareness and I acted habitually and I hurt myself or I hurt someone else. That's not blame, though. That's some level of accountability. And I think when we try to live in awareness, there's nobody to blame. I mean, again, if you want to look epigenetically, we end up blaming saber-toothed tigers. And then the saber-toothed tigers are like, you know, because they were our predators that gave us these goddamn nervous systems that just get traumatized and reactive and really are maladaptive to the 21st century. And then the saber-toothed tiger is like, don't blame me. It was, you know, it was reptiles, you know. And then the reptiles are like, Jesus Christ, it was the dinosaurs, you know. And the dinosaurs are like, we just learned how to live, you know. And then the Big Bang is like, you can't blame me. I'm just exploding gas.
You think I wanted to explode? You think I wanted a Big Bang? I was happy being a fucking singularity, you asshole. And then the saber-toothed tigers fucked everything up.
But what if instead of the and this is what's so sad about the world right now, what if there was just a paradigm of caring for ourselves and caring for each other? You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's nobody's fault. We do need, you know, we do need some account. We often need accountability when somebody just constantly escapes. I didn't do that, you know. You know, we have a quadruple indicted president who's our former president who's really, I mean, he is the maestro of escaping accountability, right?
And a great man.
And great. Will be our future, I mean, great.
Is, and will be our future president. Are you about to say he's going to fix everything?
I'm not going
to
say.
Is this why you wanted to?
No.
Is this where you're headed with this? Are you mocking?
He doesn't. You can never judge. You can never judge from outside. But I have gotten to know a little bit about sort of spending time in a person's presence and saying, does this person live in their awareness? Do they have compassion for themselves, compassion for others? And that would not be the person I would choose to embody those leadership principles. But back to the question at hand is like, can we actually create a paradigm of actually caring for our own experience and caring about others' experience without blame, right? Without blame. But maybe with some knowledge of the different interdependent histories that have made this world, that's great. And we can disagree, you know, I'm sure you and I do disagree on some of those, and that's great. It's great to disagree as friends. It's great to agree as friends. We both disagree with Ram Dass. So we both put ourselves out there a little bit. Cause you don't want to take responsibility for being, you know, a well-known comedian.
He would celebrate. Push back. I don't think he ever wanted to be like, everything I say is correct. I think he went through, there's so many phases to his spiritual evolution. And you could hear in some of the things he was saying early on, things that don't necessarily run counter to what he was saying later on. It was always went back to the central love everyone, tell the truth, be yourself, where you're at, just where you need to be. But some of the metaphysical stuff, you know, when I was, my God, like he was probably like in his 30s, maybe, when he was saying some of that stuff. And Jesus Christ, I mean, you should have heard me give ear beatings when I was reading the Celestine prophecies or like whatever weird woo-woo shit that I was trying to trick myself into believing. So I think it's great that he was trying to make some attempt to, I don't think his intent was to anesthetize people to the suffering of the world, but I think probably in his heart, he was hoping that people who were going through profound suffering could experience a little bit of like liberation, because it might act as a wedge for them to not feel completely victimized by the universe, to give them a sense that there is a possibility to choose not to be the screaming TSA person, that in relative reality, at any given moment, you can choose just what you're saying, to be kinder. You can choose, even if it's fake as fuck, even if you don't feel like it, even if you're just pissed and everything sucks in the world, you can make that choice. And it's a simple choice. You can just help. It's so simple. There's always someone who needs help, especially at the fucking airport. And in that, regardless of your epigenetic history, regardless of whether you're, and I think that's what's exciting about any monster of the day, whether it's Biden or Donald Trump or Netanyahu or Putin or Zelensky or whoever the fuck you've decided is your monster of the day, you have to acknowledge that regardless of past activity, and though if you're betting in Vegas, you can look at past activity, you could bet what future activity will be, central to every human, and I think rooted in that emptiness, is this possibility that in the next moment, you can do something totally outrageously different than what you've been doing. You can do something completely positive, completely like with the intent of helping. Even if you've been a neutron fucking star for your whole life, a selfish piece of shit, a masturbatory narcissist, you can still at any moment just stop. I believe that. I think that's in every, I think that's what makes the human incarnation the most precious incarnation, is that quality of, but just like you said earlier, then there's the next moment. I mean, not everyone's having the great epiphanies. Some people are having like the opposite of epiphanies. What is the opposite of an epiphany? What's the opposite of enlightenment?
The opposite of enlightenment is stuckness. You know,
so
just having a recurrent narrative, a recurrent about, I think for that, you know, again, this is very easy for me to say, because I have issues with both of my parents, but I'm not a survivor of sexual trauma. So, but we can work with our mind no matter what. That probably means, you know, that we need some supportive conditioning, right? So part of that would probably be a trauma therapist and other supportive conditions.
Yes.
But just that decision to say, this is workable. I can make progress with it.
Yes.
We can make progress and we can help, you know, and also we can help the TSA agents, right? By being kind, maybe for advocating for a slightly higher salary. I don't know what they get paid, but probably
not enough.
Not enough.
You know, and if you're mad at the TSA fucking agents, which is, by the way, how you can spot the people who don't travel a lot, is because they haven't surrendered to that reality of like this combination of an Orwellian dystopian nightmare and a shopping mall that is the modern day airport. They encounter the TSA and get mad. They're like, what is this? This is ridiculous. That's how you know people don't travel. You're like, well, yeah, this is what it's like, motherfucker. But, you know, if I am feeling pissed at some shitty TSA agent, I remember they have to drive to the airport every fucking day. I just have to walk through this, get my shit searched, let them fucking grab my ball, and then I'm done. But these, all day long, they got to wipe the back of their hand against strangers' crotches. They've got to listen to libertarians rail against them as they go through fucking TSA. They've got to dig through people's bags and get poked by fucking diabetes needles and like pull out old fish that someone's trying to smuggle through. So you know what I mean? Like, you can't do worse to them than what they're already encountering. What is there a more horrible job? You're on x-rays all day, looking at the gross shit in people's bags, butt plugs, dildos, weird fucking... I took my dad's ashes to scatter them through the TSA of course the bag got pulled because they probably thought it was like cocaine or something. I'm like, yeah, it was my dad. And he was very cool about it. He's like, is it okay if I touch them? Do you? And I'm like, it's fine. My dad would have thought it was funny. But then I'm like, you get a lot of ashes coming through here? And he's like, oh yeah, tons of ashes. He's like, a horse came through the other day, like horse ashes. And he's like, it was like so much ash. So that's their reality. They're fucking dealing with cremated remains, butt plugs, dildos, and fucking grumpy ass people trying to get home for Christmas. And they have to drive to the airport every day. So you can't do much worse than that to them.
Maybe that's the spiritual advice and the spiritual practice we can recommend for listeners, because we're recording this about a week before Christmas travel, so it's going to be nuts. Yeah. I don't know when it's going to air, but
next week, perfect timing.
Next time you're in the airport, thank a TSA agent and see how that shifts your airport experience.
Yeah, try that. See what happens. Yeah, try to be nice to them. They just get more mad. They just think you're smuggling dope at that point. Now you're going to get pulled away for the real fucking, the rectal probe. Man, this is I empathize with your situation. I find your advice to be beautiful and loving, but we do disagree here. I see I did what you taught me to do. I say ignorance is bliss. Put on your fucking sunglasses. Try not to look anyone in the eye and just go numb as a fucking cadaver in an ice box and just get through there and try to shield yourself from the psychic emanations that are blasting from all the cortisol soaked people dealing with that fucking TSA checkpoint.
Right.
But also be
so
nice.
Here we go.
Everybody
gets to make a choice. You can either completely shield yourself, see how that affects your experience, or you can open up and say, thank you for helping all these holiday travelers, and that choose your own adventure, folks.
And now you know the
but also, I just want to point out, Dunkin's in Charlotte, North Carolina right now, which is possibly the worst airport in the United States to transfer in. That thing's laid out like a long serpent. It is always at least a 15-minute walk if you're transferring. It is
people
amazing
run.
There. So,
Charlotte Airport, it might as well be some kind of gym where you run with your bags, because you will not go through the Charlotte Airport
that's
without
what it
seeing
is. It's
someone
a gym.
Galloping with their bags. Like, what the fuck? running. And you get people on the conveyor belt, the moving sidewalk. They're not walking down that sidewalk. They just want to stand still and ride. And you got to shove past them. So you're right. You're very smart, obviously. You get why right now. I don't feel like being nice to TSA. And also,
have you been to LaGuardia recently? LaGuardia has gotten such an upgrade the last few years. And
really?
The best tweet I saw about LaGuardia is it used to be like a bodega with some planes around it, which is absolutely true. It used to be like so not. And now it's just the most it's such a gorgeous airport now. LaGuardia Airport. Go Queens.
LaGuardia Airport. Be nice to the – don't listen to grumpy-ass Duncan. Be nice to the TSA agents, I guess. And Ethan, can you – obviously,
especially
you
if they're
are,
searching your butt plug.
Yeah. You don't know what they're going to do. Like they secretly put hot pepper sauce on your butt plug if they don't like you. Ethan, thank you so much for coming on the show. And can you, again, talk about this – year-long Dharma Moon Buddhist program. You're one of the teachers or the main teacher in this?
I'm the head of the we have a faculty of five across the 2 years of the program that I'm the head of. Also want to, you know, on air so you can't escape, invite you on my podcast, The Road Home.
Anytime.
Which is released weekly. And
let's book
and,
it.
Yeah, folks should subscribe because it's free. And, you know, if you just need noise in the background while you're gardening or getting your butt plug searched at airport security.
There you go. Great podcast.
You should listen
for that.
To a Buddhist podcast. So The Road Home. Yeah, the Dharma Moon, which has a lot, dharmamoon.com has a lot of really cool stuff on it. Has a new video course that my dad teaches, which is really easy to download if you want total go at your own pace intro to meditation. But year-long Buddhist studies, it's meets every Tuesday night live, and then everything's recorded. Starts with the basics and goes all the way through the tantric Buddhist teaching. So it's a deep survey with a great community or sangha. We're having a couple info sessions. I don't know when this is going to air, but December 19th, which is this Tuesday, with Sharon Salzberg, the great Sharon Salzberg, Finding Stability in an Unstable World. That'll be me and her. And then January 9th with my friend Shelley Tegelsky. So those will be chances to learn more about the program. But yeah, it's in its like fifth or sixth year, and it's just a really great way to connect, deepen your meditation practice, start a meditation practice, make it actually sustainable past your New Year's resolution, where it lasts for only 8 or 9 days. And meet with a great community of people, you know, all over North America and Europe who are all trying to, trying to just awaken a little bit and become more grounded and compassionate people. And as Duncan said, the Buddhist teachings are really deep and really broad, and this is just kind of a really good year-long survey course. So definitely recommend checking that out at dharmamoon.com. And and Duncan, please come on the Road Home podcast, because we need
Let's
more butt plug and old fish references on the podcast.
Those are my two favorite things to talk about. And also I will plug my new line of butt plugs that are shaped like old fish, which is an imperfect shape for a butt plug. Well, I'll talk more about that on your show. Ethan, thank you so much. You're brilliant. This is a wonderful conversation. Thanks for clarifying some stuff I was sort of trying to understand that I just read recently. And all the links that you need to sign up for that course will be at duncantrussell.com. But of course, it's Dharma Moon. You just go there. Thank you, Ethan. Happy holidays.
Thanks so much, Duncan.
That was Ethan Nichtern, everybody. Again, take his course. It's at dharmamoon.com. A year of studying Buddhism with this genius, anyone would benefit. Big thank you to my sponsors. Big fuck you to the stroller industry. A big thank you to Suno.ai that helped me create some of those beautiful songs that you heard up front. Those were all generated by artificial intelligence. And every month a new thing comes out that shivers me timbers. And Suno.ai is certainly one of those things. You want a song? You want a fairly good sounding song that you own the IP to in less than 4 minutes? All you have to do is prompt it like Midjourney or DALL-E or whatever. It's here now. They did it. And it's only going to get better. Check out, they're not a sponsor, but I love them. So check out Suno.ai. Thank y'all for listening. Come see me live. I will not be putting a podcast out next week because it is Xmas, but I will be back after that for the rest of 2024 and 2023. I didn't sleep much last night. I was making a robot sing to me. God bless you and goodbye.